Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the AfriCast. My name is Brendan Lotz, and joining me today is Robin Lee Chetty.
Hey, how's it going?
And Clinton Matos.
Hello, everybody.
How you guys doing on this week that has been far too hot for life?
Sweating.
Still alive, thankfully. I'm super happy I bought a portable air conditioner. I think a day before the heat wave hit, I was very happy in that decision. You know, it was a big purchase, but it's one of those things.
I was hoping you were going to say that you had purchased a your own home air conditioning kit. So we could do a video like Linus did.
Yeah.
From Linus Tech Tips. Anyway.
You've got a lot of money to burn. I don't.
Clinton, you had an interview with a game developer this week, I believe.
Yes, before anyone asks, it was remote. We did it over email. We didn't meet up. It was very safe.
Just well, that would be hard because it was a developer in Brazil, isn't it?
Yes. Yes. This company is called Modus Studios Brazil. People are, their ears are perking up. That's because Modus is actually a publisher. They bought the studio that used to be called The Balance Inc. and they renamed it Modus Studios Brazil. I mentioned that in the interview. We spoke to the general manager, and I just wanted to ask them about the upcoming game called Override 2. And I just wanted to speak to them about what they're doing for the sequel, what's been made better, and especially around something really interesting. They are doing a crossover with Ultraman, which is a very big franchise in Japan. Less so in the rest of the world, but in Japan, it's a very popular series. And I just wanted to touch on very quickly two questions I asked them. One is about microtransactions. In fighting games, skins and customization are very popular and you usually have to pay for them. And thankfully, that's not so in this game. In the sequel, like in the first game, you earn all your skins and customization options purely through playing the game. That's all they can say right now. They'll have more details for us in the future. Hopefully, the customization is more in-depth compared to the first game. In the first game, the customization was just, you know, change the color of your skins. Some skins were better than others, but it wasn't very in-depth. Hopefully, that changes in the second game. The other thing I wanted to mention is that it will have rollback netcode. Rollback netcode is a whole can of worms. It is so complicated. Again, I'll link to my story. I do my best to explain what rollback netcode is, and I'll also link to a video by a channel called Core Gaming, which focuses on fighting games. Basically, rollback netcode is the gold standard compared to the other kind, which is delay-based netcode, which is not very good. It just means you're going to have a better experience online, and that's especially good for us in South Africa and, I guess, the people in Brazil who live far away from data centers and will be playing against people in, say, the US and the UK. So that's a lot of stories I just mentioned in a very short amount of time. As always, we'll have links to everything, but start on my interview with Modo Studios Brazil and then go from there.
Robin, you wrote something about Burnout this week.
Yeah, that's right. So I recently read about a report that Citrix published in conjunction with Quartz, and it really kind of focused around employee burnout. It's obviously something that has come to sharper focus considering lockdown, people working remotely, and I guess a lot of the usual elements that you'd have from a normal 9-to-5 job that you kind of travel to have been removed. And a lot more stress is being placed on people as they are now essentially working from home. And as a result, the expectations have shifted quite a bit. And employee burnout is something that I think we in our own office space or our kind of work setup, we can appreciate given how many virtual events we're being invited to and the kind of pressures that's being placed on us in terms of actually covering all those events. And it's just not feasible, really. So Citrix kind of outlined a few tips that executives can perhaps put in place in their own organization. I'll run over them very quickly for you, but the first was around empowering employees to control their own technology. And that is very much an extension of BYOD, which is a hot button term a few years ago.
Yeah.
And now this is essentially an extension of that. If people are having their own remote setups at home, they should have the autonomy to kind of pick and choose the technology that works best for them. And that makes perfect sense. I think it'll alleviate a lot of stress as a result of that, because you're not necessarily working to the whim of the execs who aren't necessarily doing the same kind of work that you're doing. Yeah. So yeah, that's one element. The second one was deploying technology that reduces distraction by automating tasks. So this one, I'm a little bit on the fence about when it comes to automation. I'm not always a big fan of it. It kind of depends on how it's being put in place or how it's being deployed. I think if you can find solutions and services that allow a lot of the more mundane administrative tasks to be automated, that makes a lot of sense. But again, I think it boils down to control. So for me, that kind of element might need a bit of refining or is up for debate. The last one that they mentioned was scheduling weekly white space time for all employees. And what that essentially means is, like, essentially once a week, you are scheduling time where the employees can interact with one another, but it's not necessarily work-focused. So I've seen video conferencing platforms like Google Meet adding like party features that essentially allow people to interact with one another via the platform itself. And I think that having that kind of white space time, almost to kind of decompress and allow people to socialize within their own organization and have it not being work-related, makes a lot of sense. Again, this kind of points to mental and physical health, that the report kind of mentioned that 67% of employees have an always-on approach, as they term it. So almost two-thirds of the employees that they were interacting with said that essentially from 9 to 5, or if it's 8 to 5, or whatever you're working hours, it's essentially always on. There's no time for people to kind of decompress. Things like lunch hours, for example, now, when you're working remotely, those have kind of fallen away. People aren't using those lunch hours to do whatever, whether it be running errands or actually just enjoying lunch, taking some time out, then having a break. So, yeah, I think these are all good points for executives to have a look at. Remote working, as we've mentioned numerous times already, is the new normal. It's here to stay. So we need to start thinking a bit more proactively as far as how employees are catered for and whether or not burnout is something that is catered to.
So, Robin, I do want to just raise something here, because Microsoft earlier this year announced that they were going to be adding a sort of commute period to Teams, where you could opt to take an hour at the end of your day and use it for yourself to meditate or, you know, just chat to your colleagues. And I kind of just, it struck me as odd, because, you know, there's a very simple way of doing that, and that's to say to your employees, hey guys, maybe just take like an hour off at the end of the day, or go home early today, seeing as you'll, you know, log off. Like, there's simple things that companies could do, but it just seems like we want to find a technological solution to an analog problem. And
I hear what you're saying.
Yeah.
It's just like, I think perhaps our organization is a little bit more different. We have kind of freedom to do as we see fit. I think with larger organizations, there has to be almost, things have to be built into a process. That makes sense? Yeah. So having it built into something like Teams or whatever the video conferencing platform is, I can understand that. It's, again, I think it's more a case of, if it's not formalized for people, they won't do it. I think we also probably struggle with that as well, that we're always on, essentially, and we don't necessarily take the time. So if you kind of, not necessarily mandate it, but you build it into the actual processes of work, and maybe people will be more willing to do it, and then you potentially have the chance of reducing burnout, which is a massive, massive, massive problem.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a complex problem for sure, and one that does need to be addressed. As always, link to that story at the bottom of this post. And then to round things off, next week, Bitcoin Events will host its second iteration of CryptoFest. The first one taking place in 2019, but this year, because everything is now online, CryptoFest is going online. But that's actually really cool, because there are a number of really awesome speakers. The event is free to attend as well, so if you like cryptocurrency, or you're interested in cryptocurrency, or how it's being used, then take some time out next week, the 30th of October, and join us for CryptoFest. We are a media partner for the event, so we will be tuning in and reporting from the event throughout the day. Just to give you an idea of who will be speaking, we have Ray Youssef, who's the CEO and co-founder of Paxful. Vihan Ulafid, who's an audit partner at Mazar South Africa. We have Nathaniel Luz, who's the lead at Dash Nigeria, and many, many more folks. I mean, we have Farzam Esani, who's the CEO and co-founder of Valor, or Valar. I don't know 100% how to pronounce that name. I've only ever read it, but I'm going to call it Valor because it sounds way more awesome. So, yeah, that's happening next week on the 30th of October. We'll have a link to a story on this page, as always. And you can click that link and you can register and attend for free. It's 100% free. And there will be speakers. There will be workshops. There's a whole bunch of stuff. These events are really, really quite interesting. If you've never attended a Bitcoin event, now that it's online, why not check it out? Right? You've got nothing to lose. And you can put it on in the background and tell your boss that you're working. Right? I mean, why not? Join us. It should be lots and lots of fun. The event will be emceed by the editor of Global Crypto, executive editor, pardon me, James Preston. And yeah, join us. It's going to be a fun time. I think so. I mean, especially for the 30th is a Friday. It's a Friday afternoon. So come and join us. Right. Let's go on to today's meat of the AfriCast. We are going to be chatting about Huawei's new devices. Yay, at long last, they announced them. The Huawei Mate 40 and Mate 40 Pro. Robin, you tuned into the presentation. I also did, but you were paying attention. I was just mocking the presentation. So do you want to start us off?
Yeah, attention is a generous description, but yeah. So they have a total of four devices. There's the Mate 40, then the Mate 40 Pro, Mate 40 Pro Plus, and then the Porsche design Mate 40 RS. We're going to forget about the Porsche design one purely for the fact that it's crazy expensive, and also if they are brought into the country, they'll be so limited that the general consumer wouldn't probably get a chance to actually
interact. We wouldn't even get a review sample of them.
No, we definitely would not.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm going to focus on the Mate 40 series. A lot of really interesting hardware that's gone into this device. Specifically, we're looking at silicon here. So we kind of mentioned post-IFA that Huawei was really quiet as far as some of its Kirin stuff went. The reason was because they were working on the Kirin 9000. So this is a new SoC from Huawei. It's a 5-nanometer process. So they've obviously saw Apple's A14 Bionic and said, yeah, we can do that. Don't worry. It also supports 5G. And like Apple, they are claiming a lot of crazy numbers as far as boosts and performance. Again, we'd have to actually get the devices in, compare them to last year's iteration, also compare them to what Samsung and Apple have on their latest flagships, just to kind of get a better idea as far as performance goes. But on paper, at least, the Kirin 9000 looks mightily impressive. Then the other kind of element that was spoken about in detail, again, I think Huawei took a leaf out of Apple's playbook as far as photography went. Mm-hmm. They dedicated several minutes of their presentation to the photography on board the Mate 40 series, and just to kind of distinguish the lineup a bit. So across the board, there's a new 50 megapixel, what they're calling super sensing wide angle lens. So that's across all four devices. Then it gets a little bit different as far as the other lenses that are on the rear housing, which is now being called the space ring. If anyone remembers the Mate 30 Pro, they called that housing the halo ring. And now it's
space ring, halo ring. My goodness,
Halo ring from the
Halo games. Yes,
yeah. Perhaps they ran into some legal issues there, so they decided to rename it. But so on the regular model of the Mate 40, you're getting a 60 megapixel ultra wide and an 8 megapixel telephoto. Then when you go up to the Mate 40 Pro, it gets bumped up to a 20 megapixel ultra wide and 12 megapixel telephoto, and then when you get to the Pro Plus, It's going to be 20 megapixel ultra wide, 12 megapixel telephoto, and an 8 megapixel super zoom, which they say delivers up to 10 times optical zoom. There's also a 3D sensing lens added to the mixer. So the Pro Plus is not playing games when it comes to the photography specifications.
Sorry to jump in here, Robin, but 10x optical zoom on a smartphone.
Yeah, so
I need to see that for myself. I have to see that for myself.
Well, you mentioned that, and I think it probably segues nicely into another aspect of the presentation.
Yeah.
There was no release date mentioned by Huawei whatsoever, and we're not just talking about South Africa.
Yeah.
Globally, there has been no official release date confirmed by Huawei. As to why that is, we're going to venture a few guesses later on in the podcast, but now we have to kind of sit tight and wait to hear what the local availability and pricing is. We can, however, kind of mention what the global pricing, this is in euros.
Yeah.
So the Mate 40 will start at 899 euros, and that will be for an 8 gigabyte RAM, 256 gigabyte onboard storage version. And then for the Mate 40 Pro, it gets bumped up to 1,199 euros. Again, you're getting 8 gigabyte RAM and 256 gigabyte storage. Then the Pro Plus is 1,399 euros, and that's getting, obviously we mentioned the improved specifications as far as the camera goes. That's getting 12 gigabyte RAM and 256 gigabyte internal storage. So if we do our quick maths as far as the current exchange rate goes, the Mate 40 series essentially starts at 14,643 Rand. So that's obviously not factoring in things like import duties and all those nice elements that like to bump up the price. So yeah, that's kind of all the details we have on the Mate 40 series at the moment.
So I think those price points are really important, because if those phones, if they say Getcha and they 16 grand for a Mate Pro, Mate 40, not the Pro, that's pretty good for a flagship smartphone that's also running a 5-nanometer process. And I think that this is probably something that maybe a lot of people overlooked, because Huawei is kind of like the unwanted child of Android fans at the moment, right? Because they're not running Android these days. They're running their own custom thing.
Well, I mean, they are running Android. You just can't get Google stuff on
it. So it's like Android open source license. So it's Android, but you don't get the Google mobile services. So is it Android? It's like, I'm running Windows, but I have no start menu or my computer or anything to do with Windows.
It doesn't run any Windows apps.
Yeah. So, but what I think is important here is that they've got a 5-nanometer process, which is now clearly competing with Apple. The performance that they showed off was very encouraging. I mean, like 50% improvement over what Samsung is running. And then, like, a few other tidbits compared to previous generation Apple. But I think that this chip might be pretty interesting in terms of performance. I know Huawei was talking a lot about playing video games, and they were showing off some mobile Eve title during the presentation, but it looked really smooth, number one, and really high detailed as well. So I'm really curious about the silicon, because this Kirin 9000 chip might be a game changer for Huawei, even if they're not running Google mobile services.
Yeah, I think when it comes to the hardware, especially on their flagship devices, Huawei hasn't been lacking in any regard over the past few years. That said, the kind of lack of Google mobile services is going to be an important factor for a lot of people, regardless of what the price tag is for the regular Mate 40. So, unfortunately, Huawei finds itself, I think, in a difficult position. I know that they've been ramping up their efforts as far as HMS goes and trying to make the app gallery as competitive as possible. But at the end of the day, it's still going to take, I think, a couple of years still until HMS is really able to kind of compete with what the Play Store has to offer. So it's an interesting one. I think you have to kind of be an early adopter or someone that is well versed as far as Android goes, to kind of negotiate all those kind of elements as far as lack of Google Play services. So yeah, it might not necessarily be for everyone.
I mean, what's the point of all that power if you're not going to be able to download games that can use it? It's very odd that they chose to go the game route. If you can't get certain ones that are locked on the Play Store, this is sounding to me like buying a Ferrari, but then you're just going to drive at 9 to 5 to the office, right? Still a thing. Where are you supposed to use all that power? It seems like it's a bit of overkill for the average person who's just going to get, you know, I'm going to go to Twitter, and then I'm going to take a picture, and then I'm going to put it on Facebook. And that can be seen for a lot of devices, Apple and Android included, but it's especially important here with those Android problems and the lack of software it has access to.
Well, I mean, I think software is a temporary problem for Huawei. We're starting to see more and more applications heading to the Huawei App Gallery locally, at least. They've now also got their own map service called Petal Maps, which just to my mind is trying to sound like Apple Maps, but not. I think there's some confidence growing in Huawei's own ecosystem. obviously, that's not talking for the entire organization. There are some problems that some folks have raised, and I understand it, but I'm just looking at this from a pure technological point of view, and I'm starting to wonder if what Samsung's got up its sleeve, number one, because they now need to earn the top of the pile that they are at with regards to Android. And I mean, they don't really have much competition, but if Huawei can really show that this phone is a really good performer, and I hear what you're saying, Clinton, that perhaps people don't need all this power, but then I'll say to you, well, I mean, the Note 20 Plus Pro Max, whatever it's called, exists, and people buy that phone, and it is incredibly overpowered for a smartphone. Sure, there you have the games and stuff, the Android ecosystem to draw off of, but let's also not forget that Huawei is based in China and Tencent has a finger in pretty much every gaming pie around the world. I mean, whether that's Blizzard, whether that's Riot Games, whether that, I mean, there's so many companies that they have connections to that, I mean, I would be surprised if a company like Tencent isn't readying a release of PUBG Mobile for HMS.
That's actually the game I was going to mention.
Yeah.
I was thinking that's probably the game that a lot of people love to play on mobile. It was popular before the mobile port. It got even more popular with it, even though it got banned in China. And that's a game that isn't, well, the mobile one is optimized well, but you do want a bit of horsepower in the phone that's running it. But you don't really have it right now, but they're probably working on it. I mean, almost certainly, right? And like you said, Brendan, there's just so many big names out of China, and you kind of get that, what would you call it, a home field advantage.
Yeah.
Where you could go to your neighbor and say, hey, you know, we've got a lot of users. You've got a popular game. Let's work things out. And yeah, it will probably be a temporary problem, but we'll have to wait and see, right? Guess on our point that it's going to be a temporary problem.
The camera technology as well was very interesting, Robin. I liked the little bit they did with the windsurfers, even though my internet connection was only letting me stream it at 360p for some reason. But that looked really interesting, especially the in-camera stabilization. That looked pretty intense.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of a similar system that Vivo has on one of their flagship devices. So essentially, it's turning that lens into its kind of a standalone gimbal, and it's able to steady the image. I think with Huawei's one, there's also a lot of processing that's happening on the silicon side of things. So I think that Kirin 9000 is doing a lot of heavy lifting there. But yeah, photography has long been an area where Huawei has thrived, and I think the partnership with Leica has really helped there. And I think to the larger point, it's that Huawei doesn't have anything to worry about on the hardware side of things. They are one of, if not the best smartphone makers in that regard.
Yeah.
problem now comes into the ecosystem elements. And I just want to bring up one of the other stories I wrote about Huawei this week. It was their Q3, or rather the first three quarters of 2020 financial results. So the company posted a revenue growth of 9.9% year on year. Which sounds good, but the previous year they did 24.4% growth.
It is
positive growth, but it's obviously clearly slowed down quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And during for the press statement that accompanied the report, Huawei obviously cited COVID-19 as a big hindrance as far as its supply chain and ability to manufacture and produce products. What they did not cite in that release, though, was the impact that the kind of U.S. sanctions are having.
Yeah.
That said, the CEO, Richard Yu, during the press conference earlier this week for the Mate 40, said directly that what the United States government is doing is unfair and it's unfortunate, but Huawei is going to kind of persevere regardless. So, again, I think... for Huawei, a lot of its battles aren't happening on the hardware side of things. Its battles are happening outside of almost its control in a lot of ways.
Well, sorry, Robin, I just wanted to interject there because Huawei is about to have a hardware problem. So in September, Samsung Electronics and SK Hynix, who produce, they two of the larger DRAM chip manufacturers, announced that they'd no longer be supplying Huawei from 15th of September onwards. So that might prove a problem. Now, Huawei did hoard chips. They did hoard DRAM chips knowing that this was coming, or suspecting that this was coming, rather. And as a result, DRAM chips around the world went up in price. But now the concern is, where do they get their next batch from? Because you can only hoard chips for so long. I mean, you're going to eventually use them up, is what I'm saying. Not that they'd lose, there's a shelf life on them or whatever. Best before on a DRAM chip, my goodness. But apparently what Huawei might have done is turn to China's biggest semiconductor foundry, which is called SMIC, and they might be able to produce DRAM, but then SMIC might find itself on the entity list as well, preventing it from using US technology, and that might prove problematic for them with a company like SK Hynix, where they might be using that foundry or that architecture, or who knows. I think that for now, Huawei might be fine with hardware, but moving into the future, I'm not so sure. And then beyond that, you've also got to consider what the quality of those chips you're getting is, because, I mean, you might get a chip that's really good, and then you get one that's not as good, right? And you need to be able to control that production line, much like Apple does. And I wonder if Huawei is maybe looking at Apple and going, hey, you know what? They go from silicon to software. Maybe we need to start doing the same thing.
You know what the other problem is that they don't really have anywhere else to turn, because the other chip makers are all American. AMD,
yep.
American. Intel is American. ARM was British, but is now being bought by NVIDIA.
American.
Where do they turn to?
I mean, they can't even go to TSMC. They can't even do that. So,
do you guys, I think we've kind of pondered this or posited this question before.
Yeah.
Do you guys think that they are perhaps kind of hedging their bets on the US elections? Because my thinking is that if Trump... doesn't get a second term, that a lot of these issues fall away, because these are all issues that have been promulgated by Republican politicians. It's not necessarily a bipartisan U.S. issue here.
Yeah.
I just wonder perhaps if Huawei is just going to hold off as best it can for now, because the moment they get off that entity list, all their problems are sorted.
Robin, I'm going to play a bit of devil's advocate here and say that, yeah, I agree with you that a lot of those problems are, well, a lot of the problems that Huawei is facing is Trump-based. But in the time since the ban, the listing on the entity list last year, to now, a lot of problems have risen up for Huawei. Number one, the UK is really reconsidering putting Huawei equipment in. In fact, they banned Huawei equipment from next year being used in networks. And that's not just 5G networks. That same organization that banned Huawei equipment gave their reason for it, saying that Huawei's security practices were incredibly lacking, and they would tell them that there was an issue, that issue would get fixed, and by doing that, 10 other issues popped up. So there's that. Then there's also, like, India not wanting or not being fans of China at the moment. And during this time, I think that there's been a lot of... What's the word I'm looking for here? Not negativity.
Yeah.
It's more sort of aggression towards Huawei than there was about a year ago. And I don't know whether just Trump leaving office will be enough to, number one, bring Huawei back into a country like the US, because I don't know if that trust is completely eroded now. You know, even if what Trump said is untrue, like, I mean, there's report we've heard for, what, a year now that Huawei's been siphoning off data to the Chinese government. I haven't seen that evidence come to light, you know? I mean, you can tell me that data's going to China, cool, but data's also going to Facebook servers, yes. Right? So who do I really trust here? I'll tell you what, it's not El Zucco and his mates.
So I have another thing to add to this. I think that, let's say, you know, Biden wins, and let's say in his cabinet or in his own personal dossier or whatever, there is plans to overturn those Trump decisions with regards to Chinese companies. Even if that is in the cards, I think America has so many big problems right now that as soon as the change of power happens, I think they've got a lot of other things they have to deal with first before they get to this stuff. This stuff is incredibly important and affects millions of people, but you know what else is also incredibly important and affects millions of people? The coronavirus, of which America is a massive hotspot. So I think that, you know, if it's such a big question now, if there's a change of power in America at the end of this year, they'll be dealing with a lot of other stuff, I think, for like a year minimum. Yeah. They'll be dealing with problems from the last administration before anything else happens. And that's all considering a peaceful change of power. There are questions that if Biden wins, things might go south. So, yeah, Robin, that's a very good point to bring up. But a lot of things will have to go right before anything happens at all, I think.
Yeah, I think you guys are spot on. The kind of reason I brought it up is the fact that a lot of the hurdles that have been placed in front of Huawei are really outside the realm of it to control.
Yeah.
Again, I think the company is, and we've seen it in the financial results, the company isn't in a free fall yet, but they're clearly the momentum that kind of built up over the past decade has now been stunted severely as a result of what's been happening. And I mean, we mentioned the US. They weren't able to sell phones in the US prior to the entity list scenario anyway. It's a fact that they're able to purchase hardware from U.S. entities. That's a bigger issue.
Yeah.
I mean, they got to number two spot without having the U.S. as a market. So, again, I don't want it to come off as that I'm a Huawei sympathizer or something like that. It's just that a lot of the elements that are conspiring against the company are really things that they have no real control over. I mean, unfortunately, the best they can do is put together a really powerful smartphone and hope people want to buy it.
In the markets where they are available, absolutely. I mean, and that's the thing is, I think that there's such a huge emphasis placed on the US as this market for Huawei. But like you say, Robin, I mean, they were, I think shortly before they were put on the entity list, they entered the US market. But they were there for a very short amount of time. I stand to be corrected because I could be remembering incorrectly. Like you say, Robin, a lot of these problems came because of what Trump did, because he acted on very little information and, oh, well, all people are having their data siphoned off.
It's
fine when it's Facebook. Yeah?
Well, we should just set up their HQ now, like, in Russia, and then they're sorted, right?
Well, not really, because I don't think Trump likes Russia, or does he? I'm not sure. It's Friday today, so I just need to check the prediction.
Yeah, I don't know. He's always bending the knee to Vlad. So
let me just get the magic eight ball here. No, I can't tell what his opinion is about Russia today.
So I want to bring up something quick. I think the last time we talked about Huawei, we also talked about Oppo coming into the country and maybe eating all the leftover pie that Huawei was enjoying. But I want to talk about something else, and something that Sahil, one of our contributors, brought up the other day. Why aren't people buying Sony phones?
They're too expensive.
Yeah, so you didn't have to jump ahead of the queue there, Brendan.
I'm sorry.
the reason I brought up Sony phones is that, one, they're a big name. Everyone knows who Sony is, even if you just think, oh, I thought they only did PlayStation. I didn't know they made Android phones. So they've got brand recognition. They've got brand recognition, even if it's not the greatest right now. They're based in Japan, so they're not under any trade restrictions, at least right now. And their phones have been decent quality for a long time, but people just aren't buying them. And Brendan jumped ahead there. It's because they're very pricey. Robin, you wanted to add something to that?
Yeah, I think, sure, price is a contributing factor, but it's also really about marketing. Huawei are super aggressive when it comes to that. Samsung are. A lot of the Chinese manufacturers are extremely aggressive as far as one pricing goes, especially for the mid-range and entry-level stuff. Mm. And in terms of actual exposure, they are willing to throw a lot of money behind their devices. And I don't think that Sony necessarily do that for their smartphones. I mean, again, we're speaking anecdotally, but when I first started as a tech journalist, Sony was one of the top four or five brands in the country.
Yeah.
And slowly, their presence has kind of crept back. And I don't hear from Sony from a marketing perspective as often. I don't hear from Sony from a PR perspective very often. So if there's a lack of visibility, naturally, people aren't going to be wanting to buy your new device. And don't get me wrong, Sony makes some really beautiful and well-crafted and really powerfully spec devices, but if the visibility is down, not much I can do for, that consumers are going to want to do, because they hear about Samsung all the time. They hear about Huawei all the time. They're going to hear about Oppo all the time, because they throw the budget behind it.
Yeah, and the other reason I wanted to bring this up, sorry, Brendan, you might want to add this after I bring it up, is that Sony has an opportunity now with the release of the PS5. So people might be thinking, you know, that's a console, this is a phone. I think there might be a big opportunity for Sony to say, hey, you're going to be buying a PS5. What if, I don't know, if you buy a Sony phone, there's crossplay where you can play games on your phone, which they did do for a long time. And I think there's support, but on a very, again, it's like you said, Robin, people just don't know about these things. They're happening in the background. Sony's developing them, but people don't know. The PS5 marketing, why don't they say, here's the PS5, here's the new Sony phone. You get them, they're a nice little couple. Or what if they say, if you get a PS5, you get $50 off of a Sony phone. If you buy a PS5, you get, I don't know, free data for a year, something like that. Why aren't they bundling the advertising? Maybe they did, you know, maybe they did internal research and they found that would take away of marketing for their consoles, so they'd sell less. Maybe they've got their plan for next year when PlayStations are in the hands of people. Maybe COVID messed everything up. Brendan, I cut you off, but I just did want to mention, they have a lot of routes to try and sell these phones, but it doesn't seem like they're doing any of it.
I mean, I think it's also a question of who their market is as well, because I think the person buying a Sony smartphone and the person buying a Sony PlayStation are completely different people. But I just want to just touch on this very quickly, but we are starting to see Sony sort of coming back to South Africa. They're bringing back their TVs and that sort of thing to the country. So, I mean, it might prove maybe they bring their smartphones back en masse. I mean, I don't think that the premium range has come here, but this is the thing, is we don't know, because Sony never says anything about their smartphones. And but when they do as well, it's kind of like, okay, but what can you offer that Samsung can't? And while we're talking about this, I mean, what is LG doing? Hey, cool, you got your dual screen phone. Nobody wants to buy it, though. Can we do a good phone? I've been saying this to LG for, I don't know, how long? What's it been? 5 years now? Just make a good phone. The G4.
I think the last one they did was the G3, probably.
Would say the G4 was probably the G3, G4. That sort of era was where they were making solid devices, really good performers that were competing with the likes of Samsung and Apple and Huawei at the time. And now it's just like, we got two screens. Okay, cool. Who's that for? Tell me who that's for. For people who play games.
Wing. What about the LG Wing?
What? I don't care about who's that for. Star Trek cosplayers.
No. Just as an aside, it's very similar to another LG phone that was in the very first Iron Man movie in 2008. Do you guys remember that when he's hiding behind the rock? He's about to get hit by the shrapnel. He's got one of those little LG flip phones, which is basically an LG Wing. Just thought I'd bring that up.
But yeah, I think Huawei, in terms of the phone that they announced yesterday, I think that it is really impressive. I'm kind of glad that they didn't tease anything or try and like be coy at IFA earlier this year, because I think that the specs that they announced yesterday on paper look very good. Also, sorry, we completely glossed over their massive fast charging. What was it, 66 watt wireless fast charging? I mean, what?
But Brendan, is the charger included in the box?
Yeah, it is.
It is, yeah. Not the wireless one, though.
Yeah, yeah. The actual charger I have on good authority is in the box.
So for people who... you are wondering why that's not a stupid question, because it's not a stupid question. The new iPhones won't have a charger in the box. And yeah, we discussed that last week. We won't get into it again. But it's now in the year 2020, a question you do have to ask.
Yeah, I mean, 60... So my concern, though, is we're seeing these massive fast charging claims. I think Xiaomi this week claimed that it had like 90 watt fast charging. And it can charge a phone fully in, I think it was 30 minutes, wirelessly. Now, my concern is, what safety measures have you taken off of the battery for that to be possible? Because a lot of these times, these batteries have built-in safety measures so that you can't charge them too quickly and blow up, you know? It's astounding to me what's happening. Maybe I'm just too old to realize that charging technology has progressed.
Well, the problem is, like, a year from now, what happens? If you continue fast charging. Yeah. I know when Samsung was the S8.
Yeah.
It was really big on the wireless fast charging. I think they also manufactured their own like special accessory for that.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly. I used it for about 2 weeks and I stopped, purely for the fact that my phone got so hot.
It was also a problem with the S9. The S9 had that same problem. If you wirelessly charged it, it became unhandleable.
Yeah, so I understand the convenience of fast charging, but to make it the default, I do worry what happens a year from now. How long a charge you'll be able to hold, because again, I haven't done the science or any of the research behind it, but my assumption is that the battery will degrade quite quickly.
Yeah.
Especially given the intensity at which the fast charging is happening.
And let's not forget that lithium ion batteries are literally a bomb. Let's not forget that. Hashtag Note 7 never forget. I mean, like, yeah, I'm concerned. I get it. Like you say, Robin, I get it. I want to have a charge in 30 minutes. But, I mean, at the risk of having to replace your battery in 6 months, do you really want that? I don't think I do. I don't think I do. Is there anything else we want to mention about Huawei? Clinton?
What do we think of the notch?
I mean, it's hardly a notch, is it? It's
a hole punch is, I think, the industry term now.
Yeah, the hole punch. I like it. I want to see more mechanical front-facing cameras that lift out of the body. I think that's a better solution than the front-facing with the hole punch. It's better than apples. I'll give them that. I mean, apples are still a blight upon the face of that smartphone.
Yeah, I think it's... Like you hate it? I'm indifferent to it, to be fair. I think the only time I really notice it is if I am watching a video in full view. Depending on how dark the video is or whatever it is, or whatever the, I guess the borders on the video are, sometimes that screen notch will get in the way. But I think it'll be maybe 2 years or so before we start seeing that kind of under the display front-facing camera technology. I think we'll start seeing that more prevalently. I think only, I think Vivo and Oppo are the only ones that are really pushing that at the moment. So yeah, it's something I feel very indifferent about it at the moment. But I prefer it over that dewdrop or yeah, teardrop or whatever drop you want to call it. I much prefer it over that.
And we spoke about it right at the top, but that's, I don't know what you call it, the array of cameras at the back. Is that shaped just for marketing and because it looks cool, or?
Well, that's exclusive to the Mate, so I think it is a bit of a marketing thing. I know that the Leica branding is heavy on that, a lot more than other Huawei flagships, so I think that might be, again, look at this really cool thing. I will say it looks like it bulges out quite a bit, and I have it on good authority that it does, in fact, bulge out quite a bit.
Yeah, those are. It looks like one of the things where you need a cover that...
Yeah, you're going to have to rock a cover for that one.
Height.
Before we go, I just want to get everybody's thoughts on Celia. Hi, Celia. Huawei assistant. What do you guys think of that?
What a bad name.
Yeah, a name aside, this better be good. We don't want another Bixby on our hands, please.
You see, so here's my problem with virtual assistant, with digital assistants rather, is that the reason Siri and Hey Google, sorry, are all so good is because...
it's
just Google answered me. Yeah, it did. The reason that it's so... sorry. The reason that they're so good is because they have a lot of data to train from. So if you look at Google, I mean, they are a massive company. And while we're talking about Apple, or I mean, Huawei, Samsung, LG, Sony, all of these phones use Google. So what I think, like for me, what makes the Google Assistant so good is that it just has a lot of data, similar to Siri. Siri is exclusive to Apple devices, and all Apple phones ship with it, and therefore it has a lot of data to train from it. So why my problem with Bixby, and probably what my problem will be with Celia, is that they won't be very good for a very long time. I think now Bixby is starting to get a little bit better. I don't use it, as you just heard. But I think that with time it will get better, but the problem is that you need to have something that's on par with the other solutions to tempt people to use it, because I'm not going to use a digital assistant that's not very good, that doesn't understand things like context. Like if I say, how old is Taylor Swift? And then I say, where does she live? And, you know, these sorts of things where there's context trained into these engines. I worry that Huawei is going to meet the same fate as Bixby, just based on the fact that they're not going to have enough people to draw data from.
Yeah, so first thing, those are very weird search terms you just mentioned. Second thing...
Those real searches.
Second thing is that, like you mentioned, Celia, to my mind, or at least from my understanding, is that it's going to be really reliant on what users will actually use on smartphone itself.
Hi everybody, post-production Brendan here. Unfortunately, due to a bit of a technical glitch, we've lost the last 10 minutes of our podcast. Essentially, we were just talking about Celia and saying that Huawei's going to have to do a lot of work to make sure that it works properly. We're really sorry that you lost those last 10 minutes, and we will make sure that our equipment is fixed for next week's podcast. Once again, many apologies, but thanks so much for tuning in. Goodbye.